United States says Israel will be implementing daily four-hour pauses in its fighting to help humanitarian aid get into Gaza.
Well, I know that the U.S. Definitely supports this solution, but they also defer the decision to Israel. And in Israel, we do hear that they want the hostages released first and ceasefire afterwards.
Republican presidential candidates sparred against each other in their third debate Wednesday night in Miami, Florida.
I think the first thing to be said is true of all the debates, that the first thing is that Donald Trump is not there.
And a new report released by the nonprofit science research group Climate Central says the past 12 months were the hottest Earth has ever recorded. Today is Friday, November 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. The United States says Israel will be implementing daily four-hour pauses in its fighting to help humanitarian aid get into Gaza and for Israeli hostages held by Hamas to be released. VOA's Rick Pantaleo spoke with Middle East correspondent Natasha Mazgavaya about this and other developments in the Israel-Hamas war.
First of all, I understand that Israel will begin to implement daily four-hour pauses in fighting. That's according to the United States, amid growing pressure to allow for more aid to get into Gaza and more hostages held by Hamas to be released. What do you know about that?
Well, I know that the U.S. Definitely supports this solution, but they also defer the decision to Israel. And in Israel, we do hear that they want the hostages released first and ceasefire afterwards. So, but I guess that's a lot of the situation there is fluid and literally, I think if there is an opportunity to release maximum hostages, then Israel will grab this opportunity. Though it's, we feel by, you know, the expressions, by what we hear from Netanyahu and the military command of Israel in the past 2 days, that they feel pretty confident about their operation next to Gaza City, that it does have some tangible achievements, that they are securing the ground, that they are getting into some Hamas strongholds. Also, you know, they're having some symbolic displays there of power, say broadcasting, for instance, Israeli music from, you know, from basically minarets, to make sure that maybe the hostages will hear it and get some glimpse of hope, or singing the Israeli anthem on Gaza Beach. So it's, you know, it's also kind of not only military display of power, not only military achievements, it's also kind of symbolic achievements or message to both hostages if they hear any of it, and also to basically traumatized nation that is still waiting to hear what happened to those 239 people held by Hamas, hoping that all of them are alive indeed. So in terms of humanitarian aid, actually today I visited Nitzana Crossing. So this is a place where Israel is inspecting the humanitarian aid trucks coming from Egypt. It's quite a detour, frankly, because instead of just going from Egypt straight to Rafah, since Israel insists on its security requirements and basically on every truck to be scanned and every pallet, you know, to be taken out, also scanned, and, you know, the dogs to sniff everything to make sure that there are no explosives smuggled into Gaza under this with this humanitarian aid provided to the Palestinian that became displaced following this conflict. So actually, they I see that Israel really made an effort in the past few weeks to ramp up basically the screening process there. They brought additional scanners.
That was VOA's Rick Pantaleo speaking with Middle East correspondent Natasha Mazgavaya. Biden administration officials warned U.S. lawmakers Wednesday that a failure to pass the White House request for $61.4 billion in aid to Ukraine could result in a victory for Russian President Vladimir Putin within a week. Some Republican lawmakers have objected to additional funding for Ukraine while the U.S. national debt remains high. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
U.S. aid to Ukraine is running out. as U.S. lawmakers run short of time to negotiate President Joe Biden's $106 billion emergency national security supplemental request. Ben Cardin is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
This investment in Ukraine goes far beyond its borders. By degrading Russia's military capabilities, we are also degrading the capabilities of those who Russia works with, like Iran, Hamas, and Hezbollah. We see these actors in concert, not in isolation.
Lawmakers are racing to negotiate aid to Ukraine and Israel and funding to border security before November 17th, when a temporary government funding bill runs out. Democrats and some Republicans are arguing that all of those funding priorities should be passed together. Mitch McConnell is the top Republican in the U.S. Senate.
We should continue to invest in expanding America's defense industrial base, both to replace capabilities Ukraine is using with newer for our own use, and to ramp up production of the ones Israel, Taiwan, and our Indo-Pacific allies and partners need.
But some congressional Republicans are concerned the U.S. is funding a stalemate in Ukraine's fight against Russia, when the money could be better used domestically. Republican Senator Rand Paul.
We're borrowing the money. It doesn't make any sense. It's coming from somewhere where it would be in a productive use to where it's into the use of basically fomenting a war and continuing a war.
The Biden administration told lawmakers Wednesday the consequences of failing to fund Ukraine's fight against Russian aggression could be immediate. James O'Brien is the Assistant Secretary for European and Eurasian Affairs at the U.S. Department of State.
President Putin says if we walk away, Ukraine falls in a week.
And with winter in Ukraine looming, U.S. aid officials warn that there is now no remaining funding to support Ukraine's war needs. Aaron McKee is the Assistant Administrator for Europe and Eurasia at the U.S. Agency for International Development.
If Congress does not approve supplemental funding, our partner organizations in Ukraine would have to either reduce the number of people getting this humanitarian assistance by up to 75% or suspend our humanitarian programs entirely.
Senate Democrats address some Republicans' concerns that European nations are not shouldering the burden of supporting Ukraine. Democratic Senator Chris Coons.
There is a global coalition of 50 countries providing more than $90 billion in direct support, both humanitarian, direct budget support, military for Ukraine. Although we are the single largest donor, the contributions to the fight for freedom on the front lines in Ukraine is genuinely global.
Biden administration officials told lawmakers that European countries are watching to see if the United States passes additional aid. The officials said some countries may withdraw their support for Ukraine if the White House request does not pass Congress. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
Five Republican presidential candidates took to the stage for a third time Wednesday night with hopes of separating themselves from one another on some of the biggest issues in the forefront of American voters' minds. For a look at who stood out and who did not, I spoke with John Fortier, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington.
Well, I think the first thing to be said is true of all the debates, that the first thing is that Donald Trump is not there, and that at least so far has not hurt him, and he has a significant lead. So in many ways, I think that's probably not going to change. And so even though he wasn't there, his standing as the front runner in the polls is probably going to be intact. So you could say he's a winner, even not on the stage. I do think especially Nikki Haley performed well last night. She has had some claims to some momentum in the race and to moving up in the world and perhaps doing well in the first couple of contests. And, you know, it's important for her to continue that move. I also do think it's tricky for her that I think her support is coming mostly from people who would never vote for Donald Trump. And she has a hard time cutting into that support. But as far as her performance last night, I think she did herself some good and wouldn't be surprised to see the polls reflect that she's, you know, continuing to gain on Ron DeSantis, who essentially is probably the second place person at this time.
Who gave the best response on U.S. foreign policy?
Yeah, I think it was interesting. I think Nikki Haley was strong on this. But again, a tricky part for Republicans is that the Republican Party has some divisions, likely all supportive of aid to Israel. There are some divisions about support to Ukraine. The Nikki Haley camp, I think, is a pretty full-throated defense of support of all areas. And I think, you know, she did very well making that case. But again, I think the Republican Party has some divisions there. And again, especially with Donald Trump not being in the room, and maybe some other than Ramaswamy, the people who are more skeptical not being there, it's hard to tell how far that message will go. But she made a strong case for the more traditional Republican foreign policy, which would be supportive in both fronts of significant military and other support.
Also, I wanted to just get your take on this other aspect of the elections. Republican senators battling to win back the Senate majority say Democratic victories on Tuesday in Kentucky, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Virginia, they are an early warning and wake-up call ahead of next year's elections. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I do think Republicans have found in the 2022 midterm elections, as well as some of these special elections and off-year elections, that they have not performed as well as you would expect with a Democratic president in office. Usually there's a reaction to him, and Joe Biden's numbers are not strong. So again, Republican performance is underperformed. And that's partly, I think, because of the Dobbs and abortion issue, partly because of some motivation on the Democratic side against Donald Trump and against his style of politics. I do think, though, the presidential election is different. It's a much, much higher turnout election. And especially, I think, in the Senate, where the difference really here is often what these particular states look like. And Republicans have a very, very favorable route to taking a majority of the Senate. So I think that might be independent of all these troubles. I do think the House of Representatives might be a different story, where, again, Democrats may have a chance of taking over. So it is something Republicans have to worry about, but we'll probably have a little bit of a different look in a very high turnout presidential election in 2024.
That was John Fortier, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. We're following these other stories from around the world. Britain's interior minister has accused the country's largest police force of being more lenient toward pro-Palestinian demonstrators than other groups. The comments by Home Secretary Suella Braverman deepen a political feud sparked in Britain by the Israel-Hamas war. Spanish police say that veteran right-wing politician Alejandro Vidal Quadras has been taken to the hospital after being shot in the face in Madrid. Vidal Quadras, 78, was a member of Spain's Conservative Popular Party and its regional leader in Catalonia. He was conscious when he was taken to the hospital. Surgeons in New York have performed the world's first transplant of an entire human eye, an extraordinary addition to a face transplant. It's far too soon to know if it will offer any vision, but doctors say Aaron James is recovering well from the dual transplants last May, and the donated eye looks remarkably healthy. The past 12 months were the hottest Earth has ever recorded, according to a new peer-reviewed report by Climate Central, a nonprofit science research group. VOA's Lori London spoke with Peter Girard, Vice President of Communications at Climate Central.
The 12-month span between November of 2022 and October of 2023, so the last 12 months that just ended, were the hottest in modern history. So it means that we are approximately 1.3 degrees above pre-industrial levels, so our planet is warmed by that much. And this is a record that has stood for something like 125,000 years.
Does this include pretty much the entire world, or are certain parts of the world at relatively stable rates, or is everything heating up?
This is a global average temperature, but you're right. Different parts of the world experience temperatures differently. So it's not a universal warming. There are definitely hot spots, and there are even a few places where this year you didn't see that same rate of warming.
And we're still burning fossil fuels. It seems like the numbers are going in the wrong direction.
That's exactly right. And we've used attribution analysis to identify what the influence of climate change of those fossil fuels are on the heat that we're seeing across the world. And in many places, we've got clear identification of the fingerprints of climate change, of the influence of carbon pollution on the heat that we felt during 2023.
Given the state of the world right now and the lack of meaningful action to really turn things around, are you expecting your next 12-month record to be worse?
Yes. The next 12 months, these records will continue to fall. And 2024 is widely expected to set a new calendar year record for global heat. So as long as we continue to release carbon pollution at the rate that we've been releasing it, global temperatures will continue to rise and all of the impacts of climate change will continue to get worse.
Is there any message that you want the world leaders to take from this? We're coming up on the Global Climate Conference in a couple of weeks. What is the message for them?
This is the rare global problem that we actually know how to solve. We have the technology. If we have the political will, we could cut emissions and we could reduce carbon pollution and we could stop this warming in a relatively short span. The planet's temperature will stop rising when we stop adding to this blanket of carbon pollution that's trapping heat on our surface. So we have the solution within reach. We just need the global initiative and the agreement and cooperation to do it.
If that were to take place, if all of those things lined up, it would stay where it is, right? We would still be in a situation where we can expect extreme weather and extreme heat. But you're saying it wouldn't lead to even more catastrophic temperatures?
That's right. When pollution stops, when we reach this net zero point where we're not emitting any more than we're taking out of the atmosphere, we stop warming, but the effects you see, the temperatures you see, would still be present. However, when you get to a point where you're not polluting, when you hit that net zero point, you can start working on ways to take carbon out of the atmosphere, and that would actually begin to cool down the Earth.
That was my colleague, Lori London, speaking with Peter Girard, Vice President of Communications at Climate Central. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Kim Lewis. The Australian government could face hundreds of false imprisonment claims after the country's high court ruled that it was unlawful to indefinitely hold a person in immigration detention. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
The Canberra government says the High Court ruling could allow the release of about 100 people held by Australia in immigration detention who can't return to their home countries. About 9 detainees are deemed to be stateless, while others can't be deported because of fears of persecution at home. The decision overturns a 20-year-old Australian legal precedent that had asserted that the indefinite detention of non-citizens was lawful. The case heard Wednesday involved a stateless Rohingya man who faced the prospect of lifelong detention in Australia since no country would resettle him because of a criminal conviction in Australia for child sexual offences. The Australian government had insisted his detention was lawful because it planned to expel him from the country despite its inability to do so. Several countries, including the United States, Britain and New Zealand, had refused to accept the detainee. But the government in Canberra has stressed that resettlement in the US would be an option. Judges ordered the man, known as NZYQ, be released immediately. His case was supported by the Human Rights Law Centre, an independent advocacy organisation. Its acting managing lawyer, Josephine Langbian, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation Thursday that the court's decision will have widespread ramifications.
This is a hugely significant decision, which will have life-changing consequences for people who have been detained for years without knowing when or even if they will ever be released.
Australia's Solicitor General Stephen Donohue, one of the country's most senior legal officials, told local media that the ruling could trigger compensation claims from detainees and that undesirables could be released into the community. Donohue said that NZYQ had been detained because he raped a 10-year-old boy, but that his incarceration wasn't punitive because he was being held until he could be deported. Immigration is an intrinsic part of multicultural Australia. More than a quarter of the population was born overseas, but strict border policies have been popular with voters. Both major parties have supported a decade-old immigration policy called Operation Sovereign Borders that sends the Navy to tow or turn away migrant boats trying to reach Australian waters. The policy has been condemned by rights groups. Phil Mercer, VOA News, Sydney.
With data showing Mexico is one of the most dangerous countries for journalists outside a war zone, and with the country's long record of impunity for perpetrators, the country's media look to one another for safety. VOA's Jessica Jarrett has the story.
Cameras, a laptop, a typewriter. The tools of a journalist trade are laid out at an altar in Tijuana to demonstrate the high cost of reporting in Mexico. The country ranks as one of the most deadly for media outside a war zone, with 35 people killed in retaliation for their reporting in the past 10 years, data from the Committee to Protect Journalists shows. In 23 of those cases, justice remains elusive. In Tijuana, where two journalists were slain in 2022, reporters like Daniel Angel Rubio say the attacks weigh heavy, even after the arrests of suspects.
I think it made us all reflect on the work we are doing, on how much we put ourselves at risk, how much we put the information team at risk.
Analysts who study the effects of impunity and attacks on journalists say a lack of justice creates greater risk and sometimes results in media self-censoring. For journalists like Rubio, they must balance personal safety with getting the story out.
We are there, on the list of cities where violence can curtail freedom of expression and the community's right to know.
Irene Khan, the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Opinion and Expression, recently met with families of murdered journalists who are waiting for justice years after the killings took place.
One of the senior officials in the Mexican government recently admitted that there is 95% impunity for killing of journalists. And that is shameful for a country like Mexico that has been promoting human rights around the world.
Recognizing fallen journalists for events like the Day of the Dead is one way to underscore the role media play in supporting democracy, says Melba Adriana Olvera Rodriguez, a top human rights official of the Baja California state government. Rodriguez attended a commemoration in Tijuana earlier this month.
Journalists build democracy in countries, and for that reason, they deserve and require protections to work safely.
With Mexico appearing again on the CPJ's annual Impunity Index, a list of the countries with the worst records for successful prosecutions in the murder of journalists, media advocates agree more needs to be done to ensure Mexican reporters can work without fear. Jessica Dorit, VOA News.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Kim Lewis in Washington wishing you a good day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Like many nations, the United States dedicates a day every year to remember those who served in the nation's armed forces and to honor the sacrifice of those who perished in the service of their country. For most of the nations who participated in the First World War, that day is November 11th. On the 11th minute of the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918, an armistice, or end of hostilities, went into effect and fighting stopped. Although it was not the end of the First World War, it officially ended with the signing of the Treaty of Versailles on June 28, 1919, many considered November 11th to be the end of the conflict. In the United States, for two decades afterward, November 11th was unofficially celebrated as Armistice Day, an occasion to honor veterans of what was then called the Great War. In 1954, President Dwight Eisenhower expanded the holiday to honor all who have served in uniform, both in war and peace. And finally, in 1971, Armistice Day became Veterans Day, thus better reflecting the spirit of the celebration. Today, we honor generations of patriots who have earned the title of American veteran, a badge of courage that unites the finest group of former service members the world has ever known, said President Joe Biden. With their selfless sacrifice, our armed forces have forged and defended the very idea of America, a promise of freedom and equality, democracy and justice, possibility and hope. We owe them an incredible debt that can never be fully repaid, he said. In every generation, America's veterans have been willing to give all for what we hold sacred: freedom, justice, and democracy. They have served selflessly, sacrificed greatly, and shouldered the burden of freedom quietly, asking no glory for themselves, said President Biden. Today, let us honor them by living up to their example, putting service before self, caring for our neighbors, and working passionately to build a more perfect union worthy of all those who protect our lives and liberty.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.